Welcome back for another episode of the It's Murder Y'all podcast. I'm your host, Amber, and with me today is a man whose booty got me lost like Nemo, my husband, Rob. Say hey, Rob.
I am thicker than a Snicker.
You are. Howdy. So before we get started, I want to mentally prepare everyone for this episode. So first, this episode is going to be hella long because there are a lot of moving parts within the story. Plus, I imagine that Rob is going to have a fair amount of insight to give throughout the episode. And it is by far the longest script I've ever written, so we're probably going to break it up into two parts. Secondly, I need y'all to know up front that the specifics of this case are incredibly graphic and gruesome. I'll try to remember to give a heads up when I'm about to explain particularly graphic details, but this is your warning. Thirdly, this is your trigger warning.
I feel like this is a murder podcast, so graphic details are implied.
I know, but I'm trying to keep people from going and giving us a one-star review because it's too graphic.
It is about murder. Murder is quite graphic.
I agree wholeheartedly. So also trigger warning that this case includes mentions of child abuse and neglect, the sexual assault of a child, and the murder of a child. And finally, one frustrating thing about this case is how many inconsistencies there are in the reporting. Like, I read a book, several newspaper articles, I watched two TV episodes, I listened to several podcasts, and I'm still not clear on some of the details related to the case, but I will mention the most egregious inconsistencies as they pop up in the story. I feel like that was one hell of an intro, but this is one hell of a case, so I reckon that it's fitting. So now with that being said, let's go ahead and dive in. It was just before 4 a.m. on December the 4th, 1997, when a couple in Alma, Georgia, woke up to the sounds of their dog going crazy outside barking. According to the book, Fear Came to Town, the husband looked out the window and told his wife, quote, "It's the damnedest thing. There's three little girls out there in nothing but nightgowns," end quote. The wife quickly ran outside, wrapping the girls up in her coat and brought them inside the house while the husband called the police. Bless her little hearts, the girls were so cold they couldn't even talk at first, but eventually one of them was able to get out the words Santa Claus. Now, it was just a few weeks before Christmas, so the wife thought that maybe the little girls had snuck out to find Santa and they'd gotten lost and they needed help getting back home. A deputy from the Bacon County Sheriff's Office arrived at the couple's house, and by this point, the little girls were able to tell more of their story. As it turned out, they weren't out looking for Santa Claus the person. Instead, they were trying to get back home to Santa Claus, Georgia, where they lived. According to the girls, a man they knew named Scott Taylor had taken them and dropped them off in the middle of nowhere, which happened to be about 50 miles from their home. One of the girls added, quote, "He was shooting off Daddy's gun. It woke us up," end quote. Now, this made the deputy's spidey senses tingle, so he radioed dispatch and had them contact the Toombs County Sheriff's Office and request a welfare check for a home on Dasher Street in Santa Claus, Georgia.
How'd they come up with that address?
The little girls told them.
And how old were they?
10, 8, and then one was either 8 or 9. Sources varied. So, Toombs County Sheriff's Deputy Michael Harlan had only been out of the police academy for about 9 months when he got the call to do the welfare check. It was a little after 5 a.m. when Deputy Harlan pulled up to the one-story brick house on Dasher Street. And Dasher Street basically ended at this driveway. So the first thing that Deputy Harlan noticed was that all the lights were on in the house. Like every light in the house was on. It was lit up like a Christmas tree, which would be apt for a town called Santa Claus. But for Deputy Harlan, something about the vibes were off. So he got out of his patrol car, and as he got closer, he realized that the front door was open a little bit. He did a cursory knock on the door and he announced his presence, but nobody responded, so he walked into the house. When he got inside, he could hear two things. First, he could hear music blaring from an alarm clock, like a clock radio, as though someone's alarm was going off. Secondly, he could hear a baby crying. Now, there's some inconsistencies in terms of the actual order of the events I'm about to lay out, but I tried to piece it together as best I could from various sources. Also, things are about to get graphic, so if you were not in the headspace for that, I would suggest you fast forward a couple minutes. So Deputy Harlan is in the house, music's blaring, a baby's crying, and the hairs are standing up on the back of his neck as he makes his way through the house. From the hallway, he could see a bedroom with bunk beds, so he peeked in and saw something so gruesome that it took his brain a few seconds to register what he was seeing. There was blood, brain, and tissue sprayed all over the walls, the ceiling, and the windows. And I've actually seen crime scene photos. It is ungodly. On the top bunk of the bunk bed, Deputy Harlan saw, in his words, quote, "what's left of a small male child," end quote. After the initial shock wears off, Deputy Harlan snaps back into reality and realizes that he doesn't know if there's an active shooter somewhere in the house. So he continues his journey through the house. He has a service weapon drawn and he is ready to shoot when suddenly a little boy pops up from out under a dining room table. Deputy Harlan would later say, quote, "As my daddy used to say, it's a thousand wonders that I didn't shoot him, and I'm very thankful for that," end quote. Deputy Harlan asked the little boy where his mom and daddy were. The little boy pointed towards the bedroom. Deputy Harlan told the little boy to stay where he was, and he went to go check. He immediately noticed blood on the doorknob and around the doorframe. Deputy Harlan tried to gently push the door open, but something was blocking it, and the little boy showed him another entrance to the bedroom. When he walked in, he realized that this is where all the noise was coming from. He could hear the music from the alarm clock blaring, and next to the bed, hanging onto the sheets and sobbing, was a 10-month-old baby. He went over to the baby, and when he did, he saw the bodies of a man and woman lying in the bed, dead from massive gunshot wounds. And across the room, he saw what had been blocking the door, the unrecognizable body of a teenage girl. At this point, Deputy Harlan grabs the little boy and the baby, goes outside, and waits for backup to arrive. Now, I know I've just thrown a lot of information at you, so let's go back and start from the beginning to give you some context. Also, our dog is making noises as she gets comfortable. So if anyone hears anything weird... She
sounds very irritated when she's getting comfortable.
Yeah, she is giving me side eye right now. So, let's start from the beginning. Kimberly Denise Lamp, who went by Kim, was born in Candler County, Georgia on February 25th, 1964, making her a Pisces. Kim's family was very poor, and her parents struggled to feed their five children. When Kim was 5 years old, although many reports say 3 years old, she watched her daddy die. He'd been trying to steal a chicken or a hog to feed his family, and a farmer shot him. Shortly after her daddy's death, her mama ran off, and the five kids were separated, and they were all put into foster care. So before I continue the story, I want to talk a little bit about foster care, since it is going to play a significant role in this case. I don't know if we've explicitly talked about it on the podcast or not, but Rob actually grew up in foster care. So, Rob, I would love for you to chime in at any point as we go along, and you can share as much or as little about your own experience as you feel comfortable. So, according to the Annie E. Casey Foundation, quote, "Foster care is a temporary living situation for kids whose parents cannot take care of them and whose need for care has come to the attention of child welfare agency staff. While in foster care, children may live with relatives, foster families, or in group facilities. Nearly half of kids who enter the foster care system will return to their parents or primary caregiver," end quote. Roughly 400,000 children are in foster care each year, and some of the reasons children may be placed into foster care include physical or sexual abuse, neglect, inadequate housing, drug abuse in the home, illness, death, or imprisonment of the parents with no other suitable relatives to care for the child, and parents relinquishing their parental rights. Though foster care is intended to be a temporary service, data from the United States Children's Bureau show that on average, a foster child spends 8.3 years of their life in the system. As noted by boysandgirlsaid.org, quote, "A child entering foster care will likely live in more than four homes during the first year of care. It is common for children who grow up in foster care to move more than 15 times," end quote.
It's pretty spot on about that.
Yeah, I was thinking the same.
Me and my little trash bags and shit would be, I was a nomad.
Yeah, and you were.
That's why I don't like people touching my shit, because I never had my own shit. And so I don't want nobody touching my shit, because I, for fear they may ruin my shit that I worked really hard to procure.
Right. Kim had a similar, situation. She was shuffled around to 52 different foster homes throughout the years, once living in 17 different foster homes in 1 year.
Mm-hmm.
The disruption from being in
my numbers weren't far off from that. I don't know about 50, but
that is just
mind-boggling
to me.
It's temporary. It's temporary. And the people that are foster parents, you know what I mean? They can be like, nah, this one ain't gonna work for us because, sorry.
It's so disruptive to children's lives, which we will learn.
My life was nothing but disruptive at that point. Like for those from what I think 9 till I was 18, something like that.
And that has a profound effect.
Nothing but disruption.
I have a lot of statistics that we're going to talk about in here that show just the impact that those disruptions can have on children as they're growing up.
I am by far one of the luckiest.
Oh, for sure. For sure. Based on a lot of statistics that I'm going to say in this, like, you beat all the odds. So the disruption from being in so many different and unpredictable environments, combined with the trauma of her daddy's death and her mama's abandonment, led Kim to become dependent on drugs and alcohol at an early age, as is the case with many foster care children. A 2007 study by Vaughn et al. Showed that 49% of older foster care youth had tried drugs and 35% met criteria for a substance abuse disorder. Kim did eventually settle with a permanent foster family and was adopted by Mary Grace and Simi Driggers. The Driggers provided Kim with a safe, stable, and loving home, but as the old saying goes, hurt people hurt people, so Kim lashed out and acted out frequently. As her adopted mother, Mary Grace, would later say, though, quote, she wanted to please teachers and us too, but her heart was hurt and the world was a scary place to her. Her parents had been ripped away from her and things never seemed the same to her. We did our best and we loved her very much. That's why we adopted her and gave her the Driggers name, end quote. According to the National Foster Youth Institute, only about half of children in foster care will graduate from high school. And sadly, Kim fell on the other half of that statistic. After dropping,
I was pretty close to the middle of that one.
Yeah, but you persevered. You did it.
It was spite that fueled me at that point in time.
I mean, you know me. I survive off of spite and carbohydrates. So
yeah.
I can do all things through spite, which strengthens me. So after dropping out of school, Kim lived the life of an addict, though she did get married and have a baby named Brandy in 1985. Her addiction became too much, though, and her husband left and divorced Kim and got custody of Brandy. The next year, Kim shacked up with a deadbeat dude who shared an addiction to drugs and alcohol. In 1986 or 1987, Kim gave birth to another child, a little girl she named Amber. Side note, the inconsistency in Amber's age was really frustrating. A lot of people seem to get their information about the case from the book Fear Came to Town. And don't get me wrong, I also got a lot of my information from that book. But there are even inconsistencies within the book. So, for instance, the author wrote that Kim met the deadbeat man in 1987, but gave birth to Amber, the deadbeat's daughter, in 1986. Like, how are you going to birth a baby when you haven't even met their daddy yet? It's also reported throughout the book and some other sources that Amber was 10 years old when everything went down in 1997, but she couldn't have been 10 years old at the tail end of 1997 if she was born in 1986. I mean, I guess if she was born like very late December. But I did some digging, and I think I tracked Amber down online. And if it is truly her, which I'm 98.5% sure that it is, she was born in 1987. Anyway, so Amber was born probably in 1987. And in 1989, Kim gave birth to twins, a girl named Brooke and a boy named Bryant. The deadbeat daddy dipped out shortly after the twins were born. And now Kim was 25, single, unemployed, raising a toddler and two newborns while also battling an addiction. I'd like to note that many sources reference Kim's drug and alcohol addiction, but I never got a clear understanding of which drug she was actually addicted to. In the book Fear Came to Town, the author wrote that Kim was, quote, hooked on weed and whiskey, end quote. And I rolled my eyes because I feel like 9 times out of 10, if you hear somebody talking about somebody being addicted to drugs and it ruining their lives, you're not going to think they're talking about weed. And this was the South, so it was probably meth. And that absolutely will ruin your life. But weed, and your teeth and your skin. At any rate, Kim was not doing well, and her children were taken away by the Division of Family and Children Services, also known as DFACS. For my Bama folks, this is DHR, or the Department of Human Resources, and for my Tennessee peeps, this is DCS, or Department of Children's Services. So Kim's kids are taken away and put into foster care just like she was. And I tried to look up the statistics to see, like, how often do people that grow up in foster care have children who then go into foster care? But the only data... all the stuff I kept finding was people that got pregnant while they were in foster care, but Kim was out of the system by this point.
I can tell you from my experiences that the powers that be, I guess this was more applicable to group home, because I've done foster care, which is living with a strange family, and then I've done group home stuff, which is usually typically a state run or city run, basically group home, foster home. So it's like they pay two people to be there at all times and act as the house parents, is what they would call them. And then there's probably, I don't know, between 8 and 12 or so kids in this one house. So yeah.
So how
they,
did
they policed fraternization pretty heavily.
Yeah, but it still happened.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. But I mean, they're because of that, because of the people, you know, foster kids going buck wild on each other and squirting out other foster youngins. You know what I mean?
Yes. So Kim's kids are taken away and they're put into foster care just like she was. And at this point, I feel like a lot of people would have fallen deeper into the pit of despair and depression and addiction. And Kim did for a little bit. But then she reconnected with her younger sister, Connie, whom she'd only seen once or twice over the last two decades. And that was her first step towards turning things around. And her second step was going to church. So Kim showed up at the Mount Vernon Pentecostal Church barefoot, broke, and with everything she owned in the back of her blue Chevette. It's important to note here how ironic it is that a drug addict would show up at a Pentecostal church. Now, I'm not super familiar with the Pentecostal flavor of Protestantism.
I feel like Pentecostal is like because I've experienced a Pentecostal church, and I feel like they be putting their hands on people way too damn much. I saw a preacher throw a Bible in probably 30-ish feet across a room and hit a guy in the chest, and he went out and was like, he sounded like he was a damn suicide bomber or something. I don't know. It was very weird.
It was very weird.
I'm just saying, it was very weird.
We're going to be respectful.
That was my experience. This is my anecdote. It was very uncomfortable and weird. Pentecostal churches, in my opinion, from my experience, are, unless you grew up in them, and it probably ain't the Christian lane you're wanting to go down initially if you want to dip your toes in Christianity.
Right. Like, that's the ironic thing. So I personally was indoctrinated as Southern Baptist as a child. So I know.
And I didn't get introduced to Pentecostal until I was a foster kid, turns out.
There you go. So the Pentecostals, they do the speaking in tongues, divine healing, all that stuff. But
he threw the hell out of that Bible. I'm talking about it was like he was trying to throw that touchdown when we beat Auburn the other week.
I don't think I could keep a straight face. Pentecostalism is also one of the strictest, most conservative denominations of Protestant Christianity. Women are not allowed to wear pants. They can only wear long skirts. They also can't wear makeup or cut their hair. I also read somewhere they can't wear deodorant, which I'm like, God wants you to be stinky? Dancing, television, mixed swimming, and movies at the theater are also disapproved of. Lucky for Kim, though, the preacher at Mount Vernon, Reverend Ray Wood, was a little bit more chill, so the church wasn't quite as strict, although they did do the long hair and the long skirts thing. Mount Vernon was kind of famous or infamous for taking in the ne'er-do-wells, specifically that it was, quote, home to a bunch of drunks and drug addicts, end quote. But Reverend Wood vibed with his church's reputation because, according to him, those are the kind of folks that Jesus ministered to. So he wanted to follow those footsteps. So Kim started to get involved with the church, and she started working towards getting her kids back. She quit the drugs. She quit the drinking. She nailed down a job at a plastic food container factory, and she found a place to live. She'd really, at this point, done a 180. So even the DFACS workers were on her side when she went to court to regain custody of Amber. They laid out a plan for beginning the visitation that would eventually lead to unification. Well, at one point, and I'm not clear on when it was in the timeline, Kim called Christy Wood, who was her best friend and the wife of Reverend Ray Wood, so the preacher at the church. Kim told Christy that she didn't think she was ready to take care of a child. Kim said, quote, Amber doesn't listen to me, and I don't know how to fill her days. She's like a puppy dog. She follows me everywhere, even into the bathroom. Can't get a single moment alone with my thoughts. She gets up early and goes to bed late, end quote. Which, welcome to motherhood.
Yeah.
Christy tried to talk Kim down, but Kim was pretty adamant that she needed to give Amber back. She wanted Amber to have the childhood that she had never had, and she didn't feel like she was at a place in her life that she could really provide that for her. So Kim turned to Amber.
This is some more foster kid shit. There were a couple times when they tried to give me back to my mom, and I was like, this motherfucker ain't got her shit together.
Right. We're going to talk about that in a little bit, too, because I have questions.
I don't know if she listens to it or not, but either way, feelings be damned. In my kid brain, I was like, well, I don't know. I was probably between 13 and 15. I don't remember. It's been so long now, but they were like, hey, you can go back and live with your mom now. And I tried it for a while, and I was just like, nah, dog, nah, I can't do this. And then they put me back into a foster family scenario. And then there's another time not long after that. They were like, you want to go live back with your mom? And I just told them, absolutely not. I do not. Nope. And then that was hung over my head for a long time. But
yeah, but you wouldn't be where you are right now if you hadn't.
If I was real stupid and decided, yeah, sure, I'll go live back with my mom, incapable of taking care of a child or teenager. Yeah, I'd have never graduated high school. Shit, I'd probably be dead, to be real honest with you, or in jail.
Yeah, the outcomes for foster kids often aren't great. So here's the thing about Kim. Kim had the wherewithal to be like,
I respect her for being like, you know what, dude, that was going to be my point. I'm sorry for another tangent, but the problem with that is that I was like, they make these parents jump through these couple of hoops, and then these social workers are like, okay, well, yeah, you can have a kid. Well, yeah, but like getting a job that pays not much better than minimum wage and living with your mama and daddy or whoever, and you know what I mean? You're like, you can't give somebody a kid who's been irresponsible with a kid when they get to just the tip of the iceberg of getting their shit together. Like, yeah, you got a job and you've been clean, but buddy, like,
like one thing can cause it
you
all to fall
just
apart.
right. You just got your shit. You just started getting your shit together. Introducing a kid to that equation when you just started getting your shit together is not a good mix. And I'd seen it time and time again. Because you'd bounce around, you see the same kids from, bounce around all these different places, and you, oh shit, I thought you went back home. No,
That's so
it just,
sad.
oh yeah, it's.
And that does, that is a re, that will be reoccurring in this story. So Kim turned Amber back over to DFACS, but she did it with the intention of getting her shit together so that she could be in a place where she could take care of Amber and give her the life she deserved. She wanted her kids, but she knew that who she was right then, she couldn't be who her kids needed her to be. But she put in effort and she got her life straightened out. She learned how to care for a house. She learned how to care for a kid. Like she took it step by step, and she was able to regain custody of not only Amber, but also the twins, Brooke and Bryant. So Kim had been focusing on nothing but getting her kids back. So she'd been refusing the advances of men. At one point, she told her sister that she'd had enough of men making her life worse rather than better, which I thought was funny. But then Danny Daniels came along. Now, based on some of the research, it seems that Kim met Danny at AA, which is probably frowned upon. But it actually worked out in this situation. So Danny had struggled with a drinking problem for years, but he had beaten it, and now he was just living a quiet life as a postman in Santa Claus, Georgia. Danny was divorced and had custody of his 11-year-old daughter, Jessica, also known as Jessie, whom he'd adopted with his ex-wife. Although Kim and Danny were almost each other's polar opposites, like Kim was gregarious and outgoing, and Danny was quiet and reserved. And Danny was a good bit older than Kim, too. I believe there's about a 14-year age difference. They fell for each other hard. They were careful in how they approached the relationship, though, making sure to put their kids' best interests first. And they eventually did introduce Danny's daughter, Jessie, to Kim's daughters, Amber and Brooke, and her son, Bryant. And they all got along beautifully. And for the first time in her life, Kim felt like she finally had a family. Kim and Danny were married at Mount Vernon Pentecostal Church on December 3rd, 1992. And they lived in Danny's one-story brick ranch house in Santa Claus, Georgia. So, Rob, have you ever heard of a place called Santa Claus, Georgia? Me either. As it turns out, it is a really tiny little town, like less than 300 residents, tiny. And it's about halfway between Macon and Savannah. It's about 15-ish minutes outside of Vidalia, Georgia, which is, of course, famous for the onions. It was established in the 1930s when a pecan farmer came up with this ploy to get people to stop at his pecan stand because he was tired of people driving past his. So he figured, what is something that makes everybody happy? Christmas. And who do we associate with Christmas? Santa Claus. Let's name this place Santa Claus. Let's make it Christmassy all year round. And it worked. The town was officially incorporated in 1941, and it is complete with Christmas-themed streets, including Dasher Street, Sleigh Street, December Drive, and Rudolph Way. And residents also keep their Christmas decorations up all year round. So Kim has gone from being a homeless, drug-addicted former foster kid to being in a loving marriage, surrounded by her children, plus a bonus child, in this sweet little house that her husband had actually built with his own two hands, in this sweet little town that was centered around the happiest time of year. Danny had legally adopted Amber, Brooke, and Bryant, plus Kim's oldest daughter, Brandy, would come visit often. Life was a dream for Kim now, but she felt like something was missing. She felt like God was calling her to be a foster parent. She knew what it felt like to be a kid in foster care, just wanting to be loved and cared for. And she felt like she could provide kids with that love and care that she had always needed. So Kim and Danny completed the 10-week course required to become foster parents. Then they opened their homes to any children that needed it, from babies all the way up to teenagers. Ironically, the same DFACS workers that had taken Kim's children away from her a few years earlier now considered Kim to be one of the best foster parents they had, and they frequently brought her some of their hardest and most heartbreaking cases. In the book Fear Came to Town, the author mentioned how bad the foster care system was in Georgia at the time, but as you know, Rob, having experience, the foster care system is a shit show everywhere. Mm-hmm. I read a quote in the Justice Policy Journal that said, quote, "If the foster care system were considered a business, judged in terms of unnecessary human suffering inflicted by mismanaged systems, it would have been forced into bankruptcy long ago," end quote. There are a lot of
incredibly, incredibly well worded.
Yes.
If I had a nickel for every time I heard somebody tell me that whatever they were doing is for my best interests, I'd have a big ass bag of nickels. What's funny too, also, to get even deeper into the onion, from my experience, a lot of these social workers and handlers of foster children have experienced some type of childhood trauma themselves. And I think that sometimes their trauma has an effect on how they perceive what's going on. And I think it also can help them identify some red flags that someone that hasn't experienced trauma, you know what I mean? But in the same breath, I think that's
a really good point. I think that absolutely probably happens. And then also, one reason why the foster care system is so bad is because you get people that either A, have probably experienced something like that, or just people that genuinely care and want to help. Well, we talked about this in another episode, but people in those kinds of jobs that involve caring, especially for children, get taken advantage of because it's like, oh, well, you're doing this because you care and because you're passionate. Well, if you care and you're passionate, then we don't need to pay you because it's rewarding enough as it is. So they're underpaid, they're overworked, they are having to shoulder a lot of emotional labor.
Mm-hmm.
Which, you know, then cracks happen in the system, which there are a lot of cracks. There are a lot of foster kids, and there's a shortage of qualified, loving foster parents. So the fact that Kim and Danny provided a stable, loving home, not to mention Kim's whole started from the bottom, now we hear success story, it made the Daniels family like the go-to foster family, not just in Toombs County, but in the surrounding counties in southeastern Georgia as well. And in 1995, Kim got a call about a little redheaded girl from Bacon County who'd been removed from her home for neglect. Some sources say her name was Joanne. Others say her name was Joanna. And I'm not sure which is right, but for the sake of this podcast episode, we're going to call her Joanne because that's what Amber called her in an interview that I watched. So, of course, Kim welcomed Joanne with open arms. She quickly realized, though, that Joanne was a little needier than she'd anticipated. That poor child had been absolutely starved of attention. So she would do or say anything she could to get it. And I imagine that happens often because especially if you're with a good family, like you've gone from being neglected and abused to now you're in this place where like you're getting love and attention and you probably want more of it. And, you know, kids want attention. And a lot of times they don't care if it's good attention or bad attention. Attention is attention, especially if you've never gotten it.
My problem, and this is going to sound sad coming out, but I just wanted to be hugged and loved on. And you don't get that from foster parents. I mean, you know what I mean? Some of the ones that I enjoyed living with, that, you know, that I try to keep in contact with and stuff. Like, I got hugs from them, but like that was a big, big deal for me. It was like, man, I just wish somebody just fucking hug on me or like love on me a little bit. That's the one thing that made me feel so lonely all the time.
That's so sad. We're gonna make people sad in this episode.
Yeah, it's not a happy subject.
Because it only gets worse from here. So the Daniels home really was an incredibly loving place because, you know, having lived through it, Kim wanted to make sure that these kids felt like this was their place and they felt cared for. So Joanne loved staying at the Daniels house. And it was so different than what she was used to. Her mama, Latrell Mosley, was a fucking dumpster fire of a person. I hate this woman. So Latrell had come from a big family who was always in trouble with the law. She was 15 when she got married the first time, and that marriage only lasted a couple months, but she ended up getting pregnant with a little boy who ended up being raised by his daddy. Well, a couple years later, she marries at age 18. She marries a new guy named George Heidler, and had four kids, George Jr., Lisa, Stephen, and Jerry. By 1985, George has dipped out, and Latrell has married a physically abusive alcoholic named Lawton Mosley, who would end up being Joanne's daddy, and he made all the kids' lives miserable. The oldest Heidler kid, George Jr., was institutionalized for alcoholism. And the second oldest, Stephen, was put in juvie for threatening to beat his stepdaddy with a table leg. When he got out, Stephen basically went batshit crazy and he terrorized the family to the point that Luttrell told a social worker that the younger kids hated their older brother so much that they threatened to stab him in his sleep. So eventually, little Joanne was added to the mix. And because the house was as unstable as ever, Joanne was removed from the home. Although Joanne was loving life with the Daniels, she also missed her mama and worried about her, which apparently is common with foster care children. I guess, you know, we all want our parents to love us, even if our parents are shitbags. We just, you know, it's a thing that we have. So although Kim wasn't supposed to, she drove Joanne back to Alma in Bacon County to see her dusty-ass mama Luttrell. While Kim and Joanne were visiting with Luttrell, Kim got to meet Joanne's half-brother, Jerry Scott Heidler. He introduced himself as Scott Taylor, though. It was reported that Scott Taylor was basically his alter ego that he used when he met people that didn't know, like, the shitty white trash history of his family or his life. I know we just went over the, like, general shitassery that was the life of Luttrell Mosley and her children, but let's talk specifically about Scott. Now, side note, we're going to call Jerry Scott Heidler Scott because I think that's what he went by most often, and it's what the Daniels family called him. And there are also a few other Jerrys in this story, and I want to try to keep people from getting confused. So he will be Scott. So Scott was born on June 9th, 1977, making him a Gemini. When he was 4 years old, he was diagnosed with a heart defect that required open heart surgery to repair his mitral valve. Otherwise, he would have slowly died from lack of oxygen in the blood. Although the surgery seemingly fixed the issue, Scott and his mama milked that heart condition for all it was worth, using it as an excuse for literally everything. Luttrell even claimed that she didn't want to punish Scott because she didn't want to upset him and get his heart riled up. So what happens when you have a kid that never gets punished, plus a super chaotic and abusive home life? You get a kid that acts out. Scott was so bad at school that they put a divider around him so that he couldn't disrupt the rest of the class. And it worked for a little bit, but inevitably he still found ways to get the attention that he so desperately craved. Scott had also been held back in kindergarten and in first grade, and he was given a psychological evaluation at school, which showed that he had learning disabilities and attention difficulties. Interestingly enough, according to a study done by the American Academy of Pediatrics, children in foster care are 3 times more likely to be diagnosed with ADHD than children not in foster care. A representative from the CDC theorized that children in foster care may be more likely to experience the risk factors that we know are associated with ADHD, such as an unstable home environment, past trauma, neglect, along with a genetic predisposition. Scott was prescribed Ritalin, but he didn't like to take it. And he was supposed to attend counseling sessions, but his mama kept canceling
them. I can't believe they would have given him, they would have prescribed Ritalin considering he had a heart condition.
It was the 80s.
Yeah.
No one gave a shit in the 80s. So he was prescribed Ritalin, didn't like taking it. His mama never took him to his counseling appointments. When he was 11, Scott was arrested and charged with 2 counts of criminal trespass and 1 count of burglary after breaking into a neighbor's house and stealing some coins and some cans of Coke. As part of his sentencing, he was ordered to go live with relatives, so he moved in with his paternal aunt and uncle. Scott was doing a lot better in this new, calmer environment, but his shit-ass mama started harassing her former in-laws, who were now caring for the son that she was neglecting. So I may have this in later, but I'm going to say it now anyways. Luttrell couldn't take care of her kids, but she didn't want nobody else taking care of her kids because it was like a slight against her. So she would harass people that tried to help her kids because you ain't going to help mine, but I'm also not going to help mine. I fucking hate her. She gets worse as we go along too. So the aunt and uncle finally had enough of Luttrell's bullshit. So one day they dropped Scott off at the sheriff's office and they just left him there. So DFACS tried to find him a foster home, but there weren't any available. So he had to go back home with Luttrell, but then a home did open up, so he went and stayed there. But then a judge said he needed to be in a more permanent home, so he was switched to a new foster home with a woman named Sylvia Boatwright. Now, Sylvia did her best to care for Scott, but he was a lot. As Sylvia's adult daughter would say later, quote, "He was mean as all get out. When they would come to my house, I was proud."
So that is a Southern colloquial phrase that just you won't hear nowhere else.
That is true. She continued, "I was proud to see the day that they left. I was afraid he had hurt my mama and him just a child," end quote. Luttrell was also on her bullshit again, harassing Sylvia and her family and just being a general pain in DFAC's ass. At one point, Scott had to have another psych evaluation, and the psychologist documented that, quote, "Child entered foster care on July 2nd, 1988. Several members of the family have been involved in breaking the law, and his mother is suspected of involvement in cult-like activities, including the occult and possibly voodoo. He has a half-brother, Ralph Elrod Jr., who has been arrested for child molestation and incestuous activities, end quote. So, side note, Luttrell allegedly, I say allegedly, but it was actually in court documents, left a voodoo doll on the desk of a social worker who had taken Joanne from their home. Like, she's crazy. So there's a lot more that I could go into with Scott's history, but suffice it to say, he was a troubled kid. He didn't talk to people. He didn't have any real friends. He had several imaginary friends, including an imaginary pet mouse that he carried around and talked to incessantly. It's the only person he talked to was his imaginary mouse. He
tried How old?
Older kid through teenage years.
I think a teenager with an imaginary pet mouse in his pocket is a pretty big red flag.
Yeah, he was absolutely at least 12 at this age, at least. He tried to commit suicide multiple times, including one time when he stood in the middle of the road waiting for a vehicle to hit him, and a tractor trailer ended up jackknifing in an attempt to avoid him. Like Kim, Scott also dropped out of school and became addicted to drugs and alcohol. He was doing the hard stuff, though. He was doing basically everything that wasn't tied down. According to some reports, Scott had been an alcoholic since he was 11 years old, which...
I went through a phase kind of like that. I didn't do everything under the sun, but I was just kind of like, there was a lot... There weren't many fucks given thrown around. I'll say that.
I mean, it makes sense, like, for the situation.
I didn't really dabble like that until closer to the end of my time, my tenure as a foster kid. You know what I mean?
Well, that's the thing. The stat that I quoted earlier, like, those were specifically of older kids. Like, it's a very common experience.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
The shit, you know what? Speaking of that, one of the shittiest parts about being a foster kid is when they're done with you, they're fucking done. When you're gone, when they relinquish control of you over to you, there's no correspondence. There's no follow-up. There's no, hey, are you good? Or there's no any kind of, I went from a property of the state of Alabama to property to the United States military in the span of a week.
Yeah, it's interesting.
And then
to me,
after that, it was just, you're on your own, buddy.
Best of luck. It's interesting to me that, like, when people are in prison and they get out, like, a lot of times they have to, you know, go through like a halfway house to, like, transition back into regular life. But foster kids don't get that luxury.
It's no, just they,
like,
just give you the fucking boot, dude.
Like, here's your trash bag.
I'm still bitter about a lot of that shit, to be really honest with you. Yeah. It's hard. It, like, you know.
I don't blame you. And
it's pretty, I don't know. It's pretty triggering sometimes when I think about it, because that stuff pops up in my mind, not as much as it used to, but every now and then it does. And I'm like, man,
I mean,
so many people, I got let down by so many people. I have been disappointed and let down. I mean, it just, I assume damn near everybody's going to let me down at this point. You know what I mean? It is just built in. Yeah, they're probably going to fuck that up for sure.
I mean, it took a long time for you to get to a point to realize that, like, I wasn't going to do that to you.
Bro, I still low-key, and this is nothing against you, but I still low-key feel like I could pull in the driveway one day and you and Olivia are just gone.
I mean, it's been 17 years, my dude.
I know. I have a broken brain.
And we've been through
I don't truly believe that, but you know what I mean? Like, my foster kid brain goes, dude, nobody gives a shit. Like, that's a big reason why I don't mess around on social medias and stuff. Cause anytime I would go to type stuff out, I just spent more time deleting posts that I had thought about posting and going, nobody gives a fuck. Nobody gives a shit about what you have to say. And so I was like, just fine. I just gave up. You know, I just, nobody gives a shit.
Well, our tens of listeners give a shit, because I guarantee you a lot of them listen for you because you're funny.
Well, I appreciate folks out there appreciating my sense of humor.
Yeah.
And I will tell you, my sense of humor is what, and music is what got me through being a foster kid. I was the class clown, and that was the thing I got in trouble for hanging around the wrong kids and cutting up and being disturbing while doing school stuff. So thanks. Waka waka.
You're funny. Because of her own experiences, Kim wanted to do what she could to help Joanne, Luttrell, and Scott. She invited them to attend church with her, and she allowed Scott to stay with the Daniels family sometimes, almost as like a low-key foster situation. Although Kim was very intentional when it came to fostering, and she did everything she could to make sure her foster children felt loved and as though they were part of the family. Like, she, her and Danny will always tell the kids, like, you can call us mom and daddy if you want to. Like, they mm-hmm. really worked.
I don't like that vibe. But if I'd have had a foster parent tell me, you can call me mama and daddy, I'd have been like, shut up.
A lot of them did, though. And, like, it'd be one thing if they're like, you've got to call me mama and daddy. But they were like, hey, if you want to, like, you can call, because, you know, We love you. So I think it gave, because even Joanne, like, she called them mom and dad.
Yeah, but I don't know. I have a philosophy about all that, because foster parents aren't permanent. That's adoption parents.
Yes, but Kim, the way that she approached fostering is she wanted all of her foster kids to know that, yes, this may be temporary, but my love for you is forever. Like, if you ever need anything, I'm still here, always, forever. Because she knew what it was like.
And I have one, you know, person that I keep in contact with that's like that. You know what I mean? She tells me that every time we talk. She's like, I love you more than you know.
Kim,
you know what I mean?
Kim very much reminded me of her. Like, it's very similar vibes. So although Kim did everything she could to make her foster children, you know, feel loved, not they're part of the family, Scott never really fit in, which wasn't new because he hadn't really fit in anywhere in his life before. As noted in Fear Came to Town, quote, he often moved quietly around the rooms, stopping to examine random knickknacks, picking things up, turning them over, and squinting at the objects, end quote. He's basically just like sneaking around all the time, being a weirdo, pilfering. He's one of those where like you just turn around and he's there, which I'm jumpy, so that would give me 7 million heart attacks. He had also taken a liking to 14-year-old Jesse Daniels, who was 4 years his junior, and this will be important later. So sometime in or around 1995, Scott, who was 18 at the time, met an 18-year-old girl named Maria Spivey. Maria was actually married. She'd got married at age 17, but had planned on getting divorced. She just hadn't gotten around to it yet. So Scott and Maria had a weird relationship, in part because Scott had the social skills of a potato. They were kind of like on again, off again. Sometimes they were inseparable. Sometimes they wouldn't see each other for weeks at a time. It was very weird. Fear Came to Town described their relationship perfectly, saying, quote, they were young and trying to find something to live for in the poverty that they had been born into. And like many young people in similar circumstances, they mistook sex for love, end quote. And of course, Maria ended up getting pregnant, later giving birth to a little boy they named Joshua. Scott knew fuck all about being a dad, but several people would later say that he was good with kids. Maria had said that he loved children. He liked to play with her sister's kids and his own nieces and nephews. One of his drinking buddies agreed, saying that she would let Scott babysit her kids and he was always good with them. And Amber would say later on that Scott had been loving and kind with children, but he was very distant with adults. So Scott has a kid now, but he's still just kind of like dicking around with life. He didn't have a job, like literally had never worked a day in his life, didn't have a job. Zero employment ever. And he just kind of floated from couch to couch. Of course, he was always welcome at the Daniels home until his little infatuation with Jesse became too much for Danny Daniels to deal with. Not only was Scott 4 years older than Jesse, he was also creepy as shit, and she tried to avoid him as best she could. According to Danny's best friend, Guy Aaron, quote, he told me he thought Heidler would need to leave pretty soon. Danny didn't trust him a bit, and it was against his nature to judge anyone. But still, it was hard not to see that something was very wrong with this kid. He was sneaky and odd, showing up right next to you without making a sound. He was forever fiddling with something, studying it, end quote. After a late night incident where Scott kept compulsively calling the Daniels home to talk to Jesse, Danny decided that he had to put his foot down. The next day, he had a chat with Scott and told him that he was no longer allowed in the Daniels home. Scott reacted the same way he reacted to everything else, which was by not reacting at all. His mama was pissed, though. Latrell felt like it was a slight against her and the family, as though they weren't good enough to be around the Daniels. So her crazy, petty ass drove all the way over to the Daniels house, which is like a county away, and did fucking donuts in their front yard. And when I read about that, I was like, oh my God, Rob's head would explode. Because much like you,
if somebody came and did donuts in my front yard right now, I would very quickly thereafter be going to jail for murder.
I know you would. Much like
you. It would be so hard not to just smoke somebody because of that.
Yeah.
The dudes were coming, the city dudes that come and suck the leaves off the side of the street, he was like standing in the edge of it. And granted, my grass is going dormant right now, and it's not a big deal. And I don't have perfectly manicured grass, but inside of me, I was like, hey, bud, what? You could walk on the curb. You don't have to walk on my grass. And I'm like, it's just grass. It's just grass. These are not the thoughts you need to be having.
You're that old man. It's like, get off my lawn.
Well, he only took about 6 steps to my grass. So I was like, oh, it'll live.
Yeah. Well, Danny, he was like you. And he took a lot of pride in his house and his yard. So you'd expect him to be livid. But he kind of thought it was funny that like this grown ass adult came and did donuts in his yard because she was mad. He was probably a little relieved too that that's all that Latrell had done, because she was white trash crazy and you never know what she might would do or say. So that whole thing, like the conversation that Danny and Scott had and then Latrell's doing donuts in the yard, that was the last time that Danny would talk to Scott or interact with Latrell. So we're going to fast forward 2 years to 1997. Okay. So 11-year-old Joanne had spent about 10 weeks total with the Daniels before being returned to Latrell, which boggles my mind. Like, she apparently, you know, made the absolute bare minimum cutoff for getting her shit together. Like, here's your kid back. We've taken multiple of your children, but have this one. Think it will be great. That's going to be fine. So again, multiple children had been taken from that home. Latrell was a horrible, neglectful mother at best. Place was a pigsty, and Joanne had basically no love or supervision. Like, why would DFACS do that? Like, why would you return a child to that? Like, I get it because, like, space issues or whatever, but you're either going to do damage to that child or you're going to have to come back and get them. So, in news that is shocking to no one, life in the clusterfuck orbit of Latrell wreaked its havoc on Joanne. At 11 years old, Joanne was running wild, smoking cigarettes, and having sex. I want you to think about that for a second. That child was 1 year older than our sweet little angel baby child is right now. 1 year.
She was smoking and drinking.
Smoking and having sex. Yes. Oh. Yeah. Like, I can't carry my brain around it. I can't
fathom.
Like, that's a child.
Now, I will tell you, when, actually specifically in that group home I told you where there was like two people there and there was like 8 to 12 of us there. It was like a big 3-bedroom house that had a big add-on, and it had like, that's the add-on was like where all the girls slept and stuff, because there was a whole separate bathroom, and there was probably like, I don't know, 6 beds or 8 beds in there and shit, bunk beds and whatnot. And then there were 2 beds in each of the other bedrooms that were out, that were in the other part of the house. So there were a few times I stayed in that place, I don't know, probably 4 times during my foster kid career. And there were some hot-tailed young girls in there, and they had to stay on top of keeping folks separate.
Yeah, that makes sense, because girls, they mistake like sex for love. Like, and so, and you know, they a lot, especially if they have daddy issues, they want male attention. And so it's unfortunate.
Yeah.
And it's really sad. So things were off the rails with Joanne, and Scott wasn't doing much better. He was arrested in October of 1997 after borrowing a friend's car and driving drunk. First of all, he didn't even have a driver's license. Like, he'd never gotten around to getting one. Secondly, he was so drunk that when the cop who arrested him asked him to sign a form, the best he could do was write the letter J backwards. I don't think I've ever been, and I've been blackout drunk, I don't think I was ever so drunk that I couldn't write my name. It probably wouldn't look pretty, but I could write my name, I would think.
Yeah.
Couldn't stay upright, but I could write my name. He was arrested again in November of 1997 for stealing a Jeep Grand Cherokee, or nope, just a Jeep Cherokee and a four-wheeler. His on-again, off-again girlfriend Maria was also pregnant again, but no one was sure if Scott was the father. Over in Santa Claus, things in the Daniels home were as good as ever. Kim and Danny had been fostering 3 children, Amanda, who was listed as 8 years old in some reports and 9 years old in others, so I'm not sure which it was, her brother Corey, who was 4, and baby Gabriel, who was 10 months old. The Daniels had decided they were going to start the process of adopting the 3 children after the first of the year. 33-year-old Kim had fully embraced the stay-at-home mom lifestyle, and she was living her best life. She loved it. Like, she felt like her purpose in life was to take care of children. 47-year-old Danny still worked as a mail carrier, which was a job that suited his personality well, and it provided enough money for the family to make ends meet, although things were a little tight sometimes. 16-year-old Jessie was a smart, sweet-natured girl who was the apple of her daddy's eye. 10-year-old Amber was outgoing and gregarious like her mama, and the 8-year-old twins were absolutely inseparable, and they were adored by the family. As November turned into December, Kim was gearing up for the Christmas holiday. Because she had spent so many lonely, giftless Christmases in foster care, she wanted to make sure that her kids, foster, biological, and adopted, had the happiest, most exciting Christmases imaginable. Kim was balling on a budget, so she would look for gifts throughout the year and stash them in the attic. So by December, she already had like 50 to 60 wrapped presents under the fully decorated tree, with countless more still up in the attic. Like, she was making sure those kids got stuff on Christmas morning. December was a particularly happy time for the Daniels because, in addition to celebrating Christmas, Kim and Danny's anniversary was on December the 3rd. This year's anniversary would be their 5th, which I'm sure was an important and meaningful milestone for them. While the Daniels family was preparing for a month of celebration, shit was falling apart for Scott. On November 29th, he went to check on his baby mama, who was pregnant with a baby that may or may not be his. Maria hadn't been feeling good that day, and Scott was surprisingly worried and adamant that she needed to go to the hospital. So at the hospital, they learned that the baby had an irregular heartbeat and that Maria would need to be monitored. At one point in the evening, the baby's heart monitor started beeping, and so nurses rushed Maria out of the room for an emergency delivery, and sadly, the baby, who was a little boy, did not make it. Although on the outside, Scott seemed to be reacting in his normal, unreactive style, this baby's death had affected him deeply. He wrote this really weird poem that was basically a rewrite of like an old gospel song, and he kept asking Maria to read it to him over and over again. And then the baby's funeral was on December the 2nd, and Scott had like a complete emotional come apart at the gravesite. The next day, December 3rd, 1997.
I bet that was pretty rowdy for everybody that knew anything about him to see.
Oh, for sure. So December 3rd, 1997, Scott went over to Latrell's house, his mama's house. He'd been avoiding it because he knew that she'd interrogate him about the baby, and that's exactly what happened. So he got tired of her shit, and he left to go hang out at the house of 59-year-old Jerry Johnson. Jerry Johnson was this random guy who let people hang out at his house and like drink and play pool and stuff. Jerry was wheelchair bound due to a car accident 30 years before. And he said he couldn't figure out why a young guy like Scott, who is now 20 at this time, would want to hang out with an old dude in a wheelchair. But he felt sorry for Scott because it was obvious that he was a loner. So Scott's hanging out with Jerry and Jerry's neighbor, drinking, smoking cigarettes, playing pool. Now, normally, Scott would just sit there like a weirdo and not say anything. But on that night, he would not shut up. He kept talking about the dead baby and being at the hospital and going to the funeral and seeing the little bitty tiny baby casket. And the other guys would try to change the subject, but Scott, just he kept going on and on and on about it. So around 8 p.m., Jerry, the guy that owns the house, got ready to call it a night. Now, Jerry often got tired before his visitors were done hanging out, so he'd typically lock all the doors, do his whole, like, get ready for bed routine, and then let the visitors keep playing and drinking or whatever and leave whenever they wanted to. So, Scott was apparently a weirdly observant dude, and from hanging out at Jerry's for the past few months, he'd pretty much memorized Jerry's nighttime routine. Jerry would go around and lock all the doors, but there was a door between Jerry's porch and his kitchen that he couldn't lock because he used the outlet right outside of that door to charge his electric wheelchair at night. So the cord had to like go through it. But what he would do is he would push his heavy ass wheelchair up against the door and he'd put the brakes on so that that would be a deterrent because you have this big ass wheelchair blocking the door basically. On the night of December the 3rd, Jerry, he's done his whole routine and he has gone to bed. Scott and the neighbor, they hang out for a couple more hours. They drink one last beer. They shut off the lights and they leave Jerry's place. They went and smoked a cigarette in the alley near Jerry's house, and then the neighbor went over to his house to go to bed. Scott kind of dawdled in the alley before making his way back over to Jerry Johnson's house. Using his quiet, sneaky superpowers that always creeped people out, he slinked his way across the porch to the unlocked back door where Jerry kept his wheelchair. Scott slowly nudged the door, pushing the wheelchair forward with his skinny little body so that it could fit through, until it could fit through the gap in the door. So keep in mind, Scott was a drug addict. He never ate, so he was like a string bean. So he just needed a little bitty crack to get through. So Scott squeezes his way through the crack in the door. He was now in Jerry's house, and he went over to where he knew Jerry kept the keys to his 1989 gray and maroon Dodge van. He grabbed the keys. He slinked back out of the house. He jumped into the van, and he started driving towards the one-story brick house on Dasher Street in Santa Claus, Georgia. So we still have a lot left in this story. So we're going to call this the end of part one. So as always, sources will be listed in the show notes. Please like, subscribe, review. I don't have my notes in front of me, so I don't remember the ending to my own podcast. What is it? Oh, there we go. Please subscribe.
Something about the creek don't rise.
Yeah, there we go.
Please, Lord willing, and the creek don't rise.
Please subscribe, rate, review, tell a friend, tell your mama. We'll see y'all next week with part two. Lord willing, and the creek don't rise.